Lord, you are a merciful God. We just sang about the deep love of Jesus and how he intercedes for us. And that is always a comforting theme and something that we always fall back on. It's the thing that moves us forward. It's the thing that guides us. We just thank you for the love that you have for us. And we thank you for this time tonight. We thank you for the opportunity to study what proves to be quite a difficult passage, but we know you know what it intends, and we pray for your wisdom as we look at these texts. We pray in Christ's name. Amen. This is lesson number 27 in our series. We're going to be looking at verses 36 through 45. So we'll be finishing up chapter 11. And this is not new, but I've mentioned all this before, but just to kind of recap and give us sort of an introduction to what we're looking at tonight. Scholars are in agreement that the vision up to this point, you know, if you take the vision as in formally speaking, really starts in verse 2, has been concerned with events between the time of Cyrus, who was the Persian ruler at the time that Daniel lived, and at the time that Daniel was receiving his vision. He mentions that in chapter 10. So it records events or predicts events between that time all the way up into the death of Antiochus the IV Epiphanes, as he's called. And so the good thing about this has been that from verse 2 to verse 35, almost unanimously, the scholars lined up like ducks. I like that. That makes it my job a lot easier. I mean, that doesn't mean I can't disagree from time to time. And there were some nuanced differences and so forth. But largely speaking, the analysis was straightforward enough that everybody could see it and everybody agreed on it. But with verse 36, this agreement ends. It's over. And that's where we're starting tonight. And this is where we enter into treacherous territory. And there's a reason that the agreement ends. It's because the passage is not transparently easy to take apart. Doesn't mean I don't think we can know it, but I will say it's tough. So in verse 36 through 45, which is what we intend to cover tonight, we have the description given of what's called the king. There have been a number of proposals given by scholars over the years as to who this king might be. His name's not given any more than any of the other kings have been given. But at least up to this point with King of the North, King of the South, and oh, it's Antiochus the First. You can tell her that's Antiochus the Second. That's Ptolemy the First. Ptolemy the Second. You know, just work your way through. Here we have a king, but the identifying the historical markers is a little more difficult. So there have been a number of proposals. Some, Sam Storms and Albert Barnes in particular, there are many others, but I'm just giving you some examples of people that I have their material and have read what they have had to say. These two have proposed that the king is Antiochus the IV Epiphanes, and that what is said here is just a continuation of the description given of him in verses 21 through 35. So last week when we met, we finished up with verse 21 through 35, and we talked about this horrible person, Antiochus the IV Epiphanes. And if you take the view that these guys take, the discussion continues on this same individual, and there's more said about him. And what they have going for them is there doesn't seem to be any markers in the text that indicate a transition or a change in time. But then again, throughout the text, we would change from one king of the north to the next king of the north, and it didn't necessarily put any big markers in there. So that in itself is not unusual. But this isn't a crazy view. Doesn't happen to be mine, but that's one. Some see this king as representing either the Roman Empire, that would be John Calvin. So even though it says the king, he sees it as symbolically representing the entire empire, which we have seen that use of the term king and kingdom, those words get interchanged numerous times in the book of Daniel. I've pointed that out. So he's not whacked out in thinking that. Or some see it as maybe a series of Roman emperors. J. Rogers would be one. He's the guy that I liked his view on Daniel 7. Don't dislike his view here, but he's a little short on the details in his commentary, so it's hard for me to follow him. But anyhow, I understand, though I don't know anybody I could name specifically, that amongst some of the later reformers, not Calvin, but the Pope of Rome and the papal system was who they thought was being talked about here. Then there are those, Philip Morrow and James Jordan are two names, who believe it's talking about Herod the Great, or perhaps even the dynasty of the Herod, starting with Herod the Great. There's actually several of them. And so that's another option. And then the last option that I list here, this is probably the most popular interpretation, unfortunately, because I disagree with it strongly, that it's the Antichrist. But it's an old view. It was advanced by Jerome in 347. You know, that's pretty early in church history. He's not a dispensationalist. Dispensationalism didn't even get started until much, much later than that. At any rate, and it's been followed by many people since Jerome. So that's that. Now, I'll just say this up front. Each of these views that I've laid out, there may be more, but those are certainly the major ones that you're going to come across. Each of these views has difficulty explaining how portions of this text fit with their idea and who's being described. I don't care what view it is. Every one of them have some places where you go, I'm not sure that quite fits, but you know, if you take the view, you got to be consistent and try to make it all work. But in this passage in particular, there are a lot of places where you run into clashes. I personally think that Herod, especially as explained by Morrow, seems to be the best fit. But I'm not super duper stuck on it. Some of the other views I find attractive. For example, a series of Roman empires, I would call it a close second, or maybe Calvin's view even. There's some merit to that view. I think the passage could work as a continuation of the description of Antiochus IV. In fact, my first impression looking at it was, because of no linking and so forth, I thought that might be it. But there are a number of problems making that work. Of course, there's problems that didn't make any of you work. I find the idea that this is the Antichrist, I find that to be the least likely option, even if it's the popular view. Which seems strange because my very best commentaries, every one of them line up on this view just about. Very few go in other directions. The main problem I have with the Antichrist view is the same problem that I had seeing the 70th week of Daniel as taking place at the end of human history. Remember when we talked about all that? And you had all these sequence of, you know, 69 weeks broken up into pieces, you know, the 63 and the 7 and whatever it all was. And then he had this last week, and the futurists wanted to break off that last week and stick it way out in the future. So that makes it 2,000 years plus, because it hadn't happened yet. So it could even be more, maybe another 1,000 years for all we know. We got the same thing happening all over again here. There are a sequence of things in the passage that seem to be roughly sequential, you know, Antiochus the first, then later Antiochus the second, and maybe Seleucus the first, Seleucus the second, you know what I mean? But you see kind of a pretty general flow of history going on with some small gaps as we switch between kings, but nothing resembling a 2,000-year gap that just takes us completely out of the realm of who knows what. Just cannot see that personally. Now, one of the attractions to the view is that since the Antichrist is yet future, anything that is said about him here can't be falsified. You know what I mean by that? How's he saying? He's going to be a person who hates women. There's something said sort of like that in the passage. Well, we don't know what he looks like, so we just say, okay, this is going to be this guy who's going to hate women. Sure, but I can't prove that wrong. Whereas if I say Herod is the guy and says this person hated women, you say, wait a minute, Herod didn't hate women, so I can falsify that. You see what I'm saying? You can't falsify something that hasn't happened yet. So no matter what you say about him, it's, sure, why not, right? And in my opinion, that makes this view less attractive because it's like, there's no check and balance. There's no, it could be anything. That's a wax nose. Bend it any way you want, right? I don't like views like that. I mean, yeah, it's convenient, I admit, but I would be hesitant. So I'm bashing that view, but I just so you know, that's where I come down. So I'm going to go with the Herod view and specifically Philip Morrow's presentation. Philip Morrow, I don't know if you know that name. It was familiar to me, and I looked it up a little bit. I know that name. He lived in the early 20th century. He was a lawyer who spoke and presented cases before the Supreme Court, as well as being a theologian of sorts, apparently. In fact, one case I believe he at least helped present was the Scopes trial, the Scopes monkey trial, if you're familiar with that, in the 1925, I think it was. Anyway, it's a very interesting guy. Very interesting guy. And I'm taking his view of Herod. Now, having said that, as we go through, you're going to find many places where I'm going to go, okay, now he says this, but I don't think it quite fits. I don't see everything fitting nice and tight like I'd like to, but we'll see what we got. And then when we get all done, we'll get the end, and Vic's going to straighten me out and tell me what I should have thought. Which I'm glad he's here. All right. So as we work our way through the text, I will put the most effort into explaining how it fits with the Herod view as advanced by Philip Morrow. I'm just telling you that up front. When I find an explanation to be the best overall, while I find this explanation to be the best overall fit, there do seem to be shortcomings. And some of his explanations, well, I'll just point out as we go along, they just don't fit. And then during the discussion time at the end, I'm giving you advance notice on this. I will ask your feedback based on what you have seen today. Which do you think fits the best? So you're not stuck with my view, obviously. But evaluate my view and see how well you agree that things fit or don't fit. But then think about what you know about the other views. And I know you don't have the chance to do all the research that I might have tried to do. But I'm sure some of you have been exposed to this. That's going to be our one discussion question at the end, basically. What do you think of what I presented, and what's your view? All right. With that, let me go ahead and read the text, and then we'll dive in. Yes, sir.
I was going to ask you about where do you get that he hates women?
Get the what?
Where is it that he hates women? It doesn't say
that. It's not quite the right wording. I was. Some people take that phrasing there in verse 37 that way. It's the one beloved by women, I think, is the way it's translated in most translations. Some have understood that to mean that women aren't loved by that person. I exaggerated to say hates women.
Well, ESV, I think, gives a good idea. Understand.
Yeah, I wasn't trying to make out the translation. It was just an example.
The God of women, which is Adonis.
I'll explain. I wasn't trying to make it. I was just making an illustration. That's the first thing that came to my head, and I didn't quite quote it right. But no, it's not exactly what it says. In fact, I'll read it here in just a minute.
That rubber on the pavement.
What's that?
You left rubber on the pavement.
Well, sorry, I didn't intend to do that. I was really trying to make more of a point about falsification and what that means, and that was the first idea that popped into my head. And the king shall do as he wills. He shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak astonishing things against the God of gods. He shall prosper till the indignation is accomplished. for what is decreed shall be done. He shall pay no attention to the gods of his fathers or to the one beloved by women. There it is. He shall not pay attention to any other god, for he shall magnify himself above all. He shall honor the god of fortresses instead of these, a god whom his fathers did not know. He shall honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and costly gifts. He shall deal with the strongest fortresses with the help of a foreign god. Those who acknowledge him he shall load with honor. He shall make them rulers over many and shall divide the land for a price. At the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, but the king of the north shall rush upon him like a whirlwind with chariots and horsemen and with many ships. And he shall come into countries and shall overflow and pass through. He shall come into the glorious land, and tens of thousands shall fall, but these shall be delivered out of his hand, Edom and Moab and the main part of the Ammonites. He shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He shall become ruler of the treasures of gold and silver and all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and Cushites shall follow in his train. But news from the east and the north shall alarm him, and he shall go out with great fury to destroy and devote many to destruction. He shall pitch his palatial tents between the sea and the glorious mountain. Yet he shall come to his end with none to help him. And so that ending there, of course, is why I call it the demise of the arrogant king. So going back to verse 36, reading in the ESV, and the king shall do as he wills. He shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, shall speak astonishing things against the God of gods, shall prosper until indignation is accomplished, for what is decreed shall be done. So I think there are a number of reasons to see the king mentioned here as referring to Herod the Great. So we're going to kind of lay those out as we go through. But one reason is the sequential time frames in which things happen. The preceding verses 32 through 35, which we ended with last time, it was talking about Antiochus IV, but then remember there was a little section at the end where the Maccabees were rallying the Jews against him, and they successfully revolted and freed themselves. And for a very brief period, known as the Hasmonean rule of Israel, from 140 BC to 37 BC, they had relative independence of any outside rule. Didn't last long. Their things began to break up internally, and eventually the massive cloud of Rome moved in. So it makes sense that what we see next in the text is a reference to the events in Israel which followed immediately after the era of Hasmonean rule, which we ended with last time. Since things seem to be relatively going sequentially, you know, like I said, Antiochus I, Antiochus II, Antiochus III, and if you tick off the events, you can see they're sort of working your way along a timeline. What's the next thing that happens after the Hasmonean rule? Well, it's Herod. So there's no need to make these verses apply to Antiochus Epiphanes because really he's out of the picture. And there's no need to make a sudden leap into the far distant future to find some person whose career might conceivably fit this prophecy because there's a person who occupies center stage in Israel at the end of the Hasmonean era who answers to every item of the prophetic description given here. Now that's morally speaking, I guess that's probably an overstatement. I don't know if I would agree with that. He likes for the idea that it answers, and I, for the most part, it does, but there are a few places where I will go, maybe not. But it does seem to largely match, and it would fit the time frame. So we would expect it could be talking about Herod, since he's the next thing that happens historically. So that's a check mark in favor of it being Herod. And we have a reference here to the one whom the Gospels refer to as Herod the King, who was a usurper of the throne of David when Christ, the true king, was born. For Herod alone is called by that title in the Gospels, and he alone had the rank and authority of king in Israel in those days. He's the king in those days. So the title seems to fit. It doesn't say Herod the king, but it does say the king, and he's called Herod the king. So you can see a connection there. There's another reason to see Herod in the text. This is in marked contrast with the terms verse 40, where the Hebrew speaks of the king of the north or the king of the south. So up till now, it's been king of the north, king of the south, king. But here we have just the king. Nor can the king of verse 36 refer to either of the kings in verse 27. Remember, there was that verse in that we looked at last time, verse 27, where the two kings were lying to each other as they were at the negotiating table. Remember that? So they're called kings, but clearly in the context, it was the king of the north and king of the south that were doing the negotiating, not somebody that was just called the king. But always, both before and after, they're referred to as king of the north, king of the south, as the case may be. Many commentaries, the futurist now, the popular view, understand the king spoken of here as the man of sin, described in 2 Thessalonians 2, 3 through 10, the Antichrist, or man of sin, is another title that's used to describe what many see as the Antichrist. But the man of sin is never called a king, nor described as having kingly rank, but rather as one claiming divine worship in the temple of God and backing up his pretensions by means of miracles and lying wonders. He doesn't seem to be serving in the role of a king. Now, somebody today in my class at church, Tim, who likes the futurist view, said, well, it does seem to have a sort of authority, and a king's authority. Okay. But he's not specifically mentioned as a king. The king of Daniel 11:36 achieves his ends in a very different way. He is not a miracle worker who tries to suck people in by saying, hey, I'm performing miracles, believe in me. That's not his method. He seems to operate in a completely different manner. So to connect him with the man of sin and what we know about the man of sin and the Antichrist, there seems to be some disjunctive, some disconnect there that wouldn't fit even if he didn't mind a 2,000-year gap. It is said of this king, he shall prosper until the indignation is accomplished, or another way to translate that, as we saw in the NIV, until the time of wrath is completed, which I would see as a possible, maybe even a likely reference to the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. And Herod and his, not just Herod the Great, but his whole dynasty going down through the Herods, they were in charge all the way down through 70 AD and beyond, actually. They were the face of Rome to the Jews and serving in the role of the king. The dynasty of Herod was able, through all the political upheavals of the times, to maintain his favor with Rome and flourish in authority in Palestine until the destruction of Jerusalem and beyond, as I said. For it was Herod the king who sought to bring about the death of Christ soon after his birth with the slaughter of the infants. Of course, we read that every year at Christmas time. We know about that one. That was Herod the Great. It was Herod the king whose successors put to death John the Baptist. This was done by Herod and Antipas. And James, the brother of John, that was by Herod Agrippa, who also imprisoned Peter, intending to deliver him to the Jews. And it was his dynasty who finally sent Paul in chains to Rome. This was Herod Agrippa II, the last of a dynasty, the man who's best known to the world as he who was almost persuaded to become a Christian. You know, in the King James, where Paul speaking to Agrippa, and he said, thou almost persuadest me to be a Christian. I think some of our modern translations do a different take on that, but you know the passage. So the Herods have been all the way down through the years in authority, doing their thing, and really not very favorable toward Christianity or much for the Jews, to be honest. So with that as background, we look at the verse now. First thing said in this verse about this king is he shall do as he wills. Well, you've seen this expression before already. In this text, you may or may not remember. It's used of two other individuals. The first is Alexander the Great, whom it said, he shall rule with great dominion and do as he wills. That's 11:3. The other, in verse 16, is Antiochus the Great. I think also Antiochus the First, if I remember right. Of whom it was said, he shall do as he wills. And history shows that this monarch, too, was very successful during the first part of his reign in carrying out his evil designs. This characteristic also apparently distinguished Herod to a remarkable degree. Herod rose up from lowly origin and rank to the authority of king, in securing for himself despotic power and retaining it through all the political changes of the times. He's very adept at maneuvering and keeping the support of Rome and keeping himself in place. Every one of the Herods seemed to have that innate ability. Further, it said this king, he shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak astonishing things against the God of gods. These words are descriptive of the one that we're saying is Herod. The words above every god may be taken to mean every ruler and authority in Israel, just as God of gods could be taken to mean the supreme authority over all authorities. Gods, small g in the sense, not of necessarily religious gods, but of authorities. And if that's the case, at least in the region of Palestine, he functioned in that way. He was above every authority in the realm other than the Romans he was representing. He did successfully aspire to lordship over every authority in the land, whether priests or rulers. He assumed to appoint whom he would to the office of high priest. Even put his own brother-in-law, his wife's brother, in that office, but then after that had him murdered. So Herod was the kind of guy that, just because you're on good terms, don't get too secure. He could turn around and kill you in a heartbeat. Herod also uttered, it says, astonishing things against the God of gods. Okay, so here's the first one we come across that I said a little harder to demonstrate, and I'm not sure I'm totally signed on, but I get his point. See what you think. Morrow suggests this could be a reference to the decree for the slaughter of the babies in Bethlehem, because the expressed purpose of that slaughter was to get rid of Emmanuel, God come in the flesh, the ruler of his people, who was to be the ruler of kings on earth. So this was Herod's way of making himself secure, get rid of the king and then I won't be threatened by him. Because Herod apparently had in common with many Jewish teachers of the day a mistaken view that when Christ did come, he was going to step up to the physical throne and start taking over. And so he's saying, in speaking against Christ who had come and having him and everybody else killed to make sure he got killed, he was speaking against the Christ. Maybe. That was a little bit of a hard connection for me to swallow, but there you go. It goes on in verse 37. He shall pay no attention to the God of his fathers or to the one beloved by women. There's our beloved phrase. He shall not pay attention to any other God, for he shall magnify himself above all. So, he shall pay no attention to the gods of his fathers. Herod was an Edomite. He was virtually a Jew, but honestly, he was more of a Jew in name only, and maybe a Jew for convenience sake. A Jew when he had to be a Roman when it served better. The Edomites, who had come to Judea several centuries earlier, had been pulled into Judaism. Most of them had adopted Jewish practices like circumcision, observation of the Torah, and Herod would kind of been in this group, sort of a functional view who thought of himself and represented himself as a Jew. But as a representative of Roman authority, Herod sought to legitimize his rule over Judea by aligning himself with Jewish traditions, despite the fact that he had Hellenistic or Roman leanings. So he's split between two masters, so to speak. Despite his Jewish identity, Roman loyalty, and actions like building temples to Augustus in cities of Caesarea and Sebastian gave many Jews cause to question his commitment to Judaism and the gods of his father. So all this to say, pay no attention to the gods of his fathers in the sense that he wasn't really committed to them In name only, yes. But he could just as easily go out and build a temple to the Caesars who were saying they were gods and wanted to be worshipped. And he could build a temple where people could worship the Caesars. No problem. Well, that kind of goes against what the God of his fathers was requiring of him. So in that sense, he didn't feel that. Okay, here's our phrase. We're told that the king, Herod, would pay no attention to, or as the NIV translates it, would have no regard for the one beloved, or as the NIV puts it, the one desired by women. So there's a couple ways to translate. And before we even talk about Herod, I'll just make this comment. This is a difficult expression, and the application of it made by commentaries, regardless of who they believe the king is, never really seems to be a good fit, in my opinion. The ones I looked at was like, I just never saw a really good connection here. We're like, oh yeah, I see how that person. So first of all, you have to even wonder, what are we saying here? It appears to me he paid no attention to the God of the fathers or to the one beloved by women. So he doesn't like the God the fathers and men like, but in fact, he doesn't even like any gods that the women were excited by. I think that seems to be the logical flow of the statement, right? Regardless of how the grammar. I mean, there's one guy that contests that and said, this isn't a participle, and that reads like a participle. And maybe, but I can see logically why the translations would tend to go with this. With this rendering, I think it's good, whatever it means. Nevertheless, Philip Morrow, who understands this expression to be describing Herod, argues that the women here should be understood to be the women of Israel. Okay, fair enough. Because the ardent desire of every one of them, every woman of Israel, was that they might become the mother of the Messiah. Okay. Then he goes on to argue that Herod demonstrated that he had no regard for the Messiah, who was beloved by these women, when he attempted to murder the infant Messiah through his slaughter of the babes, as recorded in Matthew 2. We're bringing that up again. So in this sense, he destroyed the one who was loved by women and who women desired to be the mother of. That's not much better fit than anybody else, but there it is. Continuing. He shall honor the God of fortresses instead of these, a God whom his fathers did not know. He shall honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and costly gifts. So here it tells us that the king, we're saying is Herod, shall honor the God of fortresses instead of these, instead of the God of our fathers, in other words, or the God of the women, as it were. The expression God of fortresses could be a reference to Roman emperors, because they put themselves in a position of God, number one. They demanded worship. They demanded to be worshipped as a god in that it was by force that they were able to maintain this power and enforce the worship that they demanded. Okay. Herod paid them honor in the most extravagant fashion. He did it with gold and silver and precious stones and costly gifts. Now, this is very much true of Herod. I mean, this is a very good fit. This honor paid by Herod, first to Julius Caesar, then Anthony's conqueror, Augustus. And by the way, that was a tricky switch because those two got at war with each other. He managed to switch allegiance from one to the other, more or less seamlessly, and didn't get called out on it, it appears. So, interesting. That was one conspicuous feature of Herod's policy. Josephus, a first century Jewish historian, or you've heard the name, records how Herod sent delegations to Rome, also to Antony and Cleopatra in Egypt, bearing the most costly presents. And he built many fortified cities and named them in honor of Caesar. Caesarea, for example. He shall deal with the strongest fortress with the help of a foreign god, those who acknowledge him. He shall load with honor, he shall make them rulers over many, and shall divide the land for a price. Here we have a reference to one of the most prominent acts of Herod's long reign, namely the rebuilding of the Jewish temple. And in doing so, he made the temple a stronghold for Caesar. But in rebuilding it, Herod took care to make it into a fortress for its own purposes, it being one of the strongest fortresses of the land. As part of the plan, he constructed on the north side of the temple and overlooking it a strong citadel, which he called the Tower of Antonia after Mark Antony. Josephus says concerning it, but the tower itself, when Herod, the king of the Jews, had fortified it more firmly than before in order to secure and guard the temple, he gratified Antonius, who was his friend and the Roman ruler, by calling it the Tower of Antonia. So he built the temple for the Jews, ostensibly, and for their worship, but also it served as a nice fortress, especially this little tower on the corner of it. And that's mentioned some different times in the New Testament as well. In connection with the prediction of what this king would do in the chief strongholds with the help of a foreign god, the foreign god being the Caesars, we should also mention that many images and statues of Caesar, which Herod set up to be worshipped in various fortified places, we've mentioned that before. In this way, he, in his office, honored the god of forces, if that's indeed a reference to Caesar, which I'm taking it that way, whose statues he everywhere introduced as objects of worship. He fulfilled with literal exactness, those who acknowledge him, he shall load with honor. So as long as the Caesars were willing to give him the power and prop him up and keep him in place, he was willing to give them all the honor and name cities after them and throw money at them. He thought it was he liked that deal. This last clause finds a striking fulfillment in Herod's extravagant pains to glorify Caesar, which, as we've shown, went beyond all bounds. The words, divide the land for a price, or Mario Caesar is translated, parceling out for hire, were fulfilled in the practice adopted by Herod of parceling out among persons favorable to himself, land adjacent to places which it was important for him to control in case of an emergency. So he had his little plants in different places, and he would hire people to work in those places that would report back to him. That's what he sees that as a reference to, maybe. And so from these kings, we see a fairly strong correspondence between what is said here of the king and what we know of the career of Herod, with exceptions noted. Verse 40, at the end of the time, the king of the south shall attack him, but the king of the north shall rush upon him like a whirlwind with chariots and horsemen with many ships, and he shall come into countries and shall overflow and pass through. The events foretold in this part of the prophecy are said to take place at the time of the end. That is to say, they were coincident with the last era of Jewish history, which was finalized in 70 AD, though this particular event is a little before that, not much. The specific events described in this verse could be described in the events of the Actium War that marked the culmination of the power struggle between Octavian, later known as Augustus, the first Roman Empire, and Mark Antony, supported by Cleopatra VII of Egypt. That's the Cleopatra we know. The one that she and Mark Antony were apparently lovers, and they were allies in opposition to Octavian during this particular fight. At that time, the king of the south, Cleopatra, the last to occupy the throne of Egypt, aided by Mark Antony, made a push with Herod, who was in league with him, against Syria, which had meanwhile become a Roman province. The first move in the Actium War was made by Antony at the urgency of Cleopatra, in which he was assisted by Herod. Plutarch, an ancient Greek historian, writes concerning this event, Antony, being informed of these things, that is, of certain disputes between Augustus and others in the Senate, so he apparently picked up on some problems going on between Augustus and the Senate, and immediately sent a prominent Roman general to the seacoast with 16 legions. In the meantime, Antony went to Ephesus, accompanied by Cleopatra, and there he assembled his fleet, which consisted of 800 ships of burden, of which Cleopatra furnished 200, and in addition to some talents that she provided, and provisions for the army as well. So there was a land army and apparently a bunch of ships for doing battle on the sea that were in place. Antony advanced to Athens with constantly increasing forces. Augustus was completely unprepared to fight him on land with these forces. And Plutarch writes concerning this, when Caesar was informed of the magnificence of Antony's preparations, he was afraid of being forced into war that summer. He wasn't ready, and it would have been a disaster for him, for his forces, his land forces at least at this point, were inadequate. Thus, the king of the south was the first to make a push in this war, and he pushed with Herod as an ally. Notice that the predictions of the prophet were fulfilled in respect to the character of the forces engaged in war. They involved chariots and horsemen, but also ships. A strange feature of the battle is that Antony's foot soldiers outnumber those of Augustus. And although his generals urged him to engage in a land battle because he had a superior force, nevertheless, to quote Plutarch, such a slave was he to the will of a woman, that would be Cleopatra, that to gratify her, though much superior on land, he put his whole confidence in the navy, notwithstanding that the ships had not half their complement of men. So he went with the weaker option. He went with the naval and made it a naval battle instead of a land battle. If he'd made it a land battle, he could have aced it, at least according to the historical thing we're reading here. This brought on a great naval fight of Actium, which ended in a complete victory for Augustus, which did result in a king of the north coming upon the king of the south like a whirlwind with chariots and horsemen and with many ships. At that point, he had him routed. Plutarch records that after the disaster at Actium, Antony's infantry, deserted him. And this sealed the fate of Antony and Cleopatra. Verse 41, he shall come into the glorious land, and 10,000 shall fall, but these shall be delivered out of his hand, Edom and Moab, and the main part of the Ammonites. So Augustus, being referred to here as he, will come from the north, enter the glorious land, with Herod's assistance, leading to the overthrows in many regions. But Edom, Moab, and Ammon, regions of south and east Judea, escape his direct control, and they're not fully subdued. Verse 42, he shall stretch out his hand against the countries. The land of Egypt shall not escape. He shall become ruler of the treasures of gold and silver and all the precious things of Egypt. And the Libyans and Cushites shall follow in his train. So here we see Augustus conquers Egypt, gaining control of its vast treasures, gold and silver and precious things. And Libya and Ethiopia fall under his influence, or are in his train, as it's called. They follow him submissively through Roman generals. And of course, Israel's wealth was crucial in Herod's time, funding Roman expansions. It provided a source of income for him. Morrow ties this to the timeline after Actium in 30 BC when Augustus annexed Egypt. Verse 44, but news from the east and the north shall alarm him, and he shall go out with great fury to destroy and devote many to destruction. And another thing that was a little bit difficult for me in this is the he keeps being switched back and forth. We're talking about the king of the north sometimes, and we're talking about here, I think we switch back to Herod. News from the east could refer to the wise men's arrival, magi, troubling Herod and leading to the slaughter of the Bethlehem infant. So he's taking the news from the east as the news from the wise men that the Christ has been born. That'd be really amazing if that's what been talking about, that event. That's maybe, but it's very vague. It's hard to tie it down. News to the north may be a reference to Antipas' conspiracy from Rome inciting Herod's fury against his own sons, leading to the execution of his two sons. He wasn't beyond killing his own family. A picture is painted here of Herod's troubled state and his destructive fury. Says he shall pitch his palatial tents between the sea and the glorious holiest mountain, yet he shall come to his end with none to help him. Here we see a possible reference to palaces built by Herod in Jerusalem, which is between the sea, presumably the Mediterranean Sea, and the glorious holy mountain, presumably Mount Zion. Yet he shall come to his end with none to help him. So Herod dies alone, tormented by disease and remorse, with failed attempts to secure sympathy, ordering Jewish leaders killed at his death, a command that goes unfulfilled, fortunately. So again, that's the connections that he makes in the passage. I've noted the things that I'm not super happy with, but any one of these views that people take, as I walk through them, I ended up in the same position. This fits, this fits, this fits, this doesn't so much, this doesn't so much, this doesn't so much. And that's, I think, why so many different views are taken here, because it's hard to make a real tight connection. So here's our discussion question. I warned you it was coming. I explained at the beginning of today's lesson, there have been a number of proposals given by scholars over the years as to who the king discussed in Daniel 11, 36 to 45 might be. Some say it's Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, and therefore what is said here is just a continuation of what was said last week when we were looking at that particular person. Some see this king as representing the Roman Empire, John Calvin, or some a series of emperors, J. Rogers. Some see it as the Pope of Rome and the papal system. Some see it as Herod the Great, Philip Barr, that's the view I represented throughout the lesson, or James Jordan's another guy. He differs in some way, but they're agreeing on the person, though their rationale doesn't always match. And of course, the popular view is the Antichrist, advanced by Jerome in 300, and has been followed by many since. So, what do you think of the view I lean towards, and therefore spent most of my time explaining, a view proposed by Philip Morrow that this text is referring to King Herod? You're not stuck with my view, obviously. I'm not even totally stuck with my view, but it's the one I thought had made the best fit. Or is there another view you believe better fits the text? If so, why? I'm open to hearing somebody have a different idea. So that's it. I don't have any other questions, but this one's over. We got to take it on.
I think the Herod view meets more of the obligations of the text. But I don't like it, but I think it satisfies more of the obligations. So I took this view.
You did?
Yeah.
Okay, I was wondering what view you took. I came with suspense, wondering what view did Vic take? Because this is where I landed after reading it all. And I will confess to you, when I read Morrow, I call this when you read somebody that's very detailed and you're just kind of skimming over and seeing generally where it goes, I call that the 50,000 foot view. From the 50,000 foot view, Morrow looked very impressive. I thought, ooh, man, I like this guy. This looks good. Better than most of the other stuff I read. But then to carry the figure a little further, once I jumped from the plane and landed and got down in the weeds, I wasn't as happy with what I was seeing. It was a little less satisfying on some planes. Like,
I'm going to ask you about James Jordan.
Yeah.
Is that a recent author you're talking about?
I think he is. He's not known to me.
I know.
Do you know him?
Yeah, I think so. And I'm not certain. I don't have his book. What is it? You have a booklet?
I do. I have a commentary by him. In fact,
on Daniel, the whole
Daniel. Yeah, on Daniel. He took the view in Daniel 7. Remember the little horn and all that deal? He took that to be Herod also. Now, I don't think Morrow did. I think Morrow's like me. I saw that as more leaning toward one of the Caesars or something, maybe. And I think that's kind of what you said, although we may not have agreed on who the Caesar was. In the little horn in Daniel 7, yeah. I think you saw that as one of the Caesars or one of the emperors of Rome. I forget which one it was. And I think I may have picked a different one than you did, but we were kind of along the same track.
Yeah.
But James Jordan saw that as being the Herods, actually. He saw it as the dynasty, kind of like the way I handle it today. And he handles this the same way. The reason I didn't use him as my support is he uses different arguments, and they just didn't have a ring of truth to them to me. I mean, we were agreeing on the person, but the reason for, one of the ones that I came across right off the bat, this kind of turned me off right away. You know what a chiasm is? You know, where you have, like, an outline that starts here and it kind of works its way into the middle, and we've talked about that here. Well, he sees the chiastic structure in the text, which people see these chiastic structures all the time. I sometimes wonder if they don't make them up, you know, like you can get a chiastic structure out of anything, I swear. But he gets his chiastic structure, and then based on his chiastic structure, he sees proofs. Well, because this parallels this, this must be equal to this. You know, like, well, wait a minute, you're the one that made the chiastic structure, not me, you know. So, I don't know. I didn't like some of the things that in some of his early arguments, so I just...
Jordan is post-Smith. He's the one I know.
Okay. Well, he may be a really good guy. I don't know him. I've got a little sheet that I use that explains who all these people are. I have to remind myself sometimes. Let me see what it says about him.
Yeah, Jordan was one of those with Bonson and yeah. Rush Dooney.
Yeah. 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 Jordan was right in there with him.
Jordan
Bonson
is...
Passed away in the 90s, but Jordan...
Okay, James Burrell Jordan, born December 3rd, 1949, is an American Protestant theologian and author. He's a director of... Biblical Horizons Institute, an organization in Niceville, Florida that publishes books, essays, and other media dealing with Bible commentary, biblical theology, and liturgy. It adheres to biblical absolutism, including young earth creation, and is committed to the concept of biblical theocracy. After his 1982 ordination in the association, I have a hard time reading this.
Presbyterian.
What's that?
Presbyterian.
He's Presbyterian.
Yeah, I think he is.
Yeah.
Anyways, he believes in young earth creation. Emphasizes Trinity and biblical absolutism. He's a theocratic guy, so he would see, you know, bringing biblical standards into government of sorts. He served since 2000 as head of the Department of Biblical Studies and Biblical Theological Seminary in St. Petersburg, Russia, where he teaches Old Testament and eschatology. So, interesting guy. I'm not familiar with him, but that's... everybody I use, I try to do a little bio on him like this. So I kind of think, who are we talking about here? When did he live, and what kind of schools did he go to?
Man, I'm thinking of. He's very bright, but militant.
Okay, well, that sounds like what we're dealing with there.
He's a very militant Presbyterian.
Okay, it sounds like it. I mean, you know, he ended up taking the view that I took. It just the reasons he gave just. I don't know, I just said, I'm going to go with Morrow, because I like the way he argued, maybe because he just had that sort of lawyerly... But again, when we got down in the weeds, there were a few times that... what happened to my thing here? Somehow we lost our connection. Oh, it's just working a minute ago.
When you switched to the thing, I think it...
It went away, huh? Sometimes... I have to do this to make it work. Did that make it come up? There it is. I don't know why it does that. It's been doing weird stuff to me lately. And it scares me because I think somehow I've lost it. I lost it, but I have to go in there and tell it to duplicate the screens again. So anyways, oops. All right, got it back up there again. So you see Herod as being a...
They're all hard, but Herod seemed to be the better of the possible explanations.
Okay.
But, he didn't acknowledge the God of his fathers, which it wasn't literally his fathers.
Yeah.
Because he was, like you said, he was Edomite, right?
Yeah.
And so, but he... rejected the God of women as well, which would be Adonis.
Yeah, that's where Morrow said he did that by trying to assassinate the Messiah. I don't know, that seemed like we ought to find something better than that. Don't you think? I don't know. I mean, obviously he did that. I'm not contesting the historical fact.
If you take it like you did, that it's a reference to Christ.
Yeah.
The Messiah that's going to be born of of a Hebrew woman.
Yeah.
Which was a great anticipation on their part. They were all looking. Every young woman was hoping she'd be the one.
Yeah, the seed of the woman from all the way from Genesis 3:15, right? You know, I can kind of see that, but it's just, I don't know. Couldn't come up with anything better, that's for sure. If I had, I would have.
And it doesn't fill out the what happens in the afterwards, because I mean, he dies shortly after the Christ is born.
Yeah.
So within a year, probably.
Well, and there's some going back and forth between the first Herod the Great and then his dynasty as a whole, which we're kind of standing back and saying it includes all of them in one sense, started by him.
Yeah. Well, so, they occupied different parts of his
of the picture.
His, territory that he originally had.
I mean, he makes it work, and it's not crazy. And again, I thought it fit better than anything else I read.
Well, it did squeeze in the Moabites.
Yeah.
That was important.
Yeah. Yeah, there were some places where it really fit very well.
Yeah, if you look at a map of Samaria, I mean of Judea and Samaria and Galilee, Perea, the area he occupied was much more. It went all the way up into Caesarea Philippi, beyond that to the river, I think. And so he had a larger area. I think David almost had the same area. Not quite.
King David?
He covered most of it, all of it except for the furthest part north.
So who had more, Herod or David?
David conquered most of this area. Solomon consolidated it, but Solomon wasn't a conqueror.
Right.
He just kind of consolidated. But there was a little segment going up here north towards Damascus, on past Damascus.
Yeah, I wish I had taken time to, or been able to take some time to include some map. I got into time trouble in my preparation this morning, and so I ended up throwing some things together that I'm amazed that we have a lesson here tonight.
Yeah, all things considered, this is amazing.
What's that?
All things considered, that is amazing.
Yeah. Because I was sitting there late last night, and I told Sam, don't even think about waiting up for me. Just go on the bed. And I was in there trying to stay awake. I was eating these Tic Tacs, you know, just to kind of keep myself awake while I was trying to read. And she said she was in bed listening to me eating Tic Tacs and not hearing me type on the keyboard. She said it was discouraging.
You don't do Sandy like I did Eli.
What's that?
Hand her help you?
A chart. To make the last few minutes before we go to church.
Yeah, I'm usually a little more prepped a little earlier than that, in a little better shape by the time we get down to Saturday night. I'm usually, you know, pretty much got it in the bag, but boy, I didn't last night. I've been just trying to get some traction all week long, and I just kept reading this theory and reading that theory. And I just couldn't. My fingers didn't want to start typing yet. You know, it's like I didn't see something that really grabbed me. And then finally I said, you know, of all the stuff I'm reading here, I like Morrow about the best. Let's just roll with it. So then once I did that, I was able to get in gear, but I may have made that decision a little too late.
Jim Jordan, I didn't have that to work with. I didn't know about his writings on it, but I would like to see it. Because it might be helpful.
Yeah.
Frankly, I didn't care for him and his attitude.
Right.
He's a hard person
maybe
to be around.
Maybe he's changed since then.
Hmm?
Maybe he's changed since then.
He might have become more relatable, but man, he wasn't that back then.
You know,
we're hostile to anybody that wasn't Presbyterian.
Where I got a lot of these. Well, I got a lot of these names. I have a commentary called Daniel in the Preterist Den. I've mentioned several times. Yeah. And it's a guy who writes a commentary on Daniel with all the emphasis being on what's wrong with what the preterists are saying. Because he doesn't like, of course, I'm more or less a preterist, so he's kind of more or less writing against me.
These girls know what a preterist is?
We've talked about it before.
Okay.
So he feels like most commentaries that write commentaries on Daniel don't say enough about what the preterists are saying and show why they're wrong. And so he wanted to write a commentary that did that. And when he does that, he's quoting all these preterists. I go, oh, there's a guy I need to buy his book. And there's a guy. So he's giving me the names of preterists out there, and I go buy their books, and I read them for myself and decide whether I like them or not. So I actually am using him as a shopping list. But I also look at his arguments. And if he says something against the preterists, I want to hear what he has to say. Because he's not a dummy. He knows his Hebrew, and he gives very technical arguments, and he gets into the weeds.
Yeah, he's good.
So, I want to hear the other side. I'm fine with that. That's good. It's been a helpful book. Although he would probably be amused at how I'm using it. Or maybe not. Any other thoughts? Any of the others have just a favorite?
I'm anxious to hear Jerry's thoughts. Mm-hmm.
The same?
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay.
What's that?
No. With Herod.
You like that
I went back and forth on, because we're going from chapter 2 with the four different empires. We've stopped with Greece, with Antiochus the IV. So my brain wants to see verse 36 moving into Roman Empire.
Which, in a sense, time-wise, Herod is in that era.
Herod's kind of right in that beginning.
Yeah.
But I didn't really see a lot. When I tried to look at the history of Herod himself and then compare what was being said, I didn't really see all of the various things that get pointed out. But when I looked at Rome, I couldn't really find a whole lot that I wanted to really like with that side either. So.
Well, we've actually got a little bit more to deal with. We've got one more chapter. It's a short chapter. It's only 12 verses. Quite likely we could finish next lesson. I don't know. We'll see. I won't know. I never know until I get into it. My pastor's always asked me, how far do you think you'll get? I have no idea. He said, you don't know? No, I don't. I haven't studied it yet. I'll let you know. It drives him crazy.
You'll have trouble with the numbers if you figure that out. Then.
Yeah, there's that little bit at the end. But there's also a little bit of a twist on the what on the surface looks like just the resurrection. I think, if I'm remembering right, I'll have to look at it more because I just didn't even get into it because I didn't have time. But I think Morrow takes that as more of a spiritual resurrection, like people receiving the gospel. I don't know. I've got to look at that whole thing. It doesn't read that way to me at first, but then
Jesus is using the same ideas right out of Daniel and John chapter 5.
Okay.
And I think I'd go with Jesus. It's a general resurrection.
Yeah. Well,
what it sounds like in Daniel.
Just in terms of some of the other things, that, I don't know, I haven't looked at it yet, so I can't comment.
So Daniel, it works to the end of the Jewish history as the people of God. And that's what the final remarks in chapter 12 points to, how that's wrapped up.
Right.
But that's not the end of history. It's just the end of the history of the Jews. And that Daniel was concerned about the history of the people of God, the Jews. His question were all answered in the prophecy as far as that goes.
Right. Right. Yeah. So we're coming in for the landing soon. like I said, probably next time, but then I may stretch it out to two. I don't know. I doubt at 12 verses, surely I ought to be able to cover that one lesson.
So what's your views on Ezekiel 37?
Ooh, I was going to ask Sandy what her view was on this. Do you go with these three men?
You know, Sandy doesn't make up her own views. Sandy listens to what Bob is saying.
Well, if these four are going for that
ditto, what did Bob say?
If these four are going for that view, then these four will go for that view. So now it all comes down to Blake. Which view do you hold? You going with the rest of the crowd?
I think he's going with the Pope.
Titus. I don't have a view.
That's okay.
And I lean towards Herod now.
It's well, that's an easier good. One to manage. This is the domain that Herod had. And you can have the full push and pull from the north and the south. And Herod's domain. But it's still not totally easy.
Yeah. I wish it was, but.
Since Antichrist was the popular view, could it be a double fulfillment? Herod being a type of the future Antichrist?
Well, you know, there are people who do that with Antiochus and the Antichrist. I had never heard anybody do that with Herod. I don't know. I'm still trying to maybe reevaluate a little bit of my thinking about the Antichrist in general. I'm not saying I throw it out. I haven't gone back and revisited a lot of passages. I read a book recently by Gentry where he takes some interesting stances on some passages. I always thought referred to one thing and he takes it another way. I didn't make it right, but it's kind of giving me food for thought. So some of that's in flux in my thinking right now as far as the Antichrist and what he looks like, and I don't know.
So, what about Ezekiel's temple? Where are you going to put it?
What's that?
Ezekiel's temple.
Oh, I haven't even begun to look at that. I mean, that's so after I get done with Daniel, the plan, at least that I'd agreed with my elders on, I guess I have to touch base with them again, but the projection is finish Daniel, then I'm going to give a high-level survey of Ezekiel. I'm not going to go verse by verse through all 30-whatever chapters. And I will try to give you a feel for the book, try to cover some of the really significant texts and the action that's spelled out there, and then maybe deal with some of the prophetic texts that would have some bearing on Revelation. Because the whole thing here is preparation for Revelation, ultimately.
You still end up with 38 and 39. Everybody gets rushing there.
It's what?
Ezekiel 38 and 39, you're going to get in the top.
Gog and Magog.
Huh?
Gog and Magog.
Gog and Magog, yeah. You're going to have the people with their views on Russia.
Yeah, I'll have to look at it. I have no preconceived ideas of what any of that means. I've read the book of Ezekiel, but you know, many times when you're reading through that section, you're like, yeah, okay.
It's still a mystery.
It's a mystery to me at the moment, but I will try to unveil the mystery, or I may just be like this and say, here's the best I can do, and you know, you can only do what you can do, right? We pray for wisdom and hope that God opens and gives us some insight. All right, folks, I'll pray and we'll let y'all go. Father, we just are thankful for this time we've had tonight and working our way through a text that is difficult in many ways, but not all scriptures are equally easy. And yet you give us many helps and aids, and you give us understanding, and we just pray for a greater understanding that we might learn these things and glorify you by knowing them. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.